Mr. Speaker.
You're at the intersection of business and politics. This is the 14th and G podcast from Melman Consulting. Now, here's our host, Dean Hinkson.
Thank you for setting your podcast out at 14th and G. I am your host, Dean Hinkson. The state of the podcast is good. We can make this a joint address, jointly joined by my good friend, Republican Bruce Melman, Democrat David Thomas. Gentlemen, welcome back to 14th and G.
Thank you, Dean. It's good to be back.
Good to have DT back. It's without a punching bag, it's just less fun.
How'd the Dolphins make out?
Well, first of all, it's the, I guess, the Swimming Panthers. They're the Panthers.
The Swimming Panthers.
They had a great meet. They won the middle school champs. Very exciting.
Well, so much happening up and down the board. We've got a lot to go through. But before we look ahead, why don't we just look back? Because we did have, it was not a State of the Union. It was a joint address to Congress, as the president's first address is known. He may not know what the State of the Union is just a couple months in, but he's working hard.
It's kind of hard to believe a year hasn't gone by. It feels like a year has gone by.
It's hard to believe. Started out with a lot of obviously some shenanigans there on the floor. Nothing says 21st century opposition like an old man shaking his cane at the president.
I have a lot of thoughts on that in particular, but what I would say is that it's so disappointing. I thought like the State of the Union is one of the last great traditions here in town, and I've had the opportunity to be in that room when the president has addressed Congress before, and it's not that we need everybody to get along. I kind of like the back and forth of the sides cheering and standing and sitting, but to have the Supreme Court and the Joint Chiefs, it's a great moment in our democracy, and I guess the only reason I am surprised is that I found myself surprised, because that tradition, too, appears to be thrown out the window.
I'm holding up a tiny sign right now that says, wah, wah.
The former record holder for that speech, President Bill Clinton, clocked in at 88 minutes, and Trump beat him by 12.
True or false,
you stood for the whole Clinton speech.
I stood for all 88 minutes, and I was tired. It gets hot in that room, too, under the lights. And so I don't know how those people stood up. Maybe that's why people were so cranky by the end. It's just too long.
Don't lock your legs. CBS YouGov poll, not an outfit known for their right-leaning friendliness. Up and down the board, approval for the speech, approval of individual content, pieces of the speech, clocking in at between 60 and 75% approval. Certainly the White House feels like it was a home run. The Democrats did not cover themselves in glory as the loyal opposition. What was his name? The congressman from Houston?
I prefer not to share it.
Yeah, okay. He got censured.
Al Green.
You know what? How can you not remember Al Green?
Because I wish the Reverend Al Green was a member of Congress. That would go much better.
Well, to your point, have sympathy for the Democrats who's just like, should we stand? Should we, turn our back? Should we not come? Should we come? It's ultimately, hey, here's a plan. Let's not stand when a boy with brain cancer is made an honorary member of the Secret Service. It's like, yeah, it's okay to stand and clap occasionally for some things. I mean, you saw whether it's Reagan or Obama, judge the moment by the specific item that you're being asked to stand for. But I've got some sympathy. The Dems right now are in disarray. They don't know how to oppose the president. We've seen the resistance is happening. It's coming from the states via the attorney generals. It's lots of lawsuits. I think it's 29 or more executive orders and other efforts by the administration have been stayed by courts. So the problem is that doesn't make good TV. And the president and the team made really good TV in the old sort of Ronald Reagan style, where you salute to somebody up with the first lady.
It's a bunch of nonsense. It was horrible. I like that you're reflecting back on the great times when all the Republicans were willing to stand and cheer for Barack Obama. I sure don't recall that one.
You lie.
I remember that one.
Was that guy censured? How did Republicans vote on that?
He was not. He was not censured, but you know what he did have to do? He had to call up Rahm Emanuel and apologize, which actually sounds harder to do. I would not.
I think Al Green should be required to call Rahm Emanuel and apologize.
I would rather take the censure for sure.
But what I will say, I got another thing to say. No, what I'll say is this: there was some good TV. The problem is by the time that Senator Slotkin was able to say a response, it was about 3 a.m.
She did a good job.
Her message was incredibly effective. And I think that should serve as a model for Democrats moving forward. When you sit down and you talk about the economy, the bills are going to come due here. And the economy, you already start to see having real structural problems. Just look at what Jerome Powell said today about where inflation going and what's going to happen to interest rates here. It's coming. And then we'll see how people react. We'll see if those ratings on the CBS poll stay as high.
We're going to see. Democrats are going to need a message. They're going to need their own momentum. We are 1 week away from the current funding mechanism keeping the federal government open expiring. The current CR ends on March 14th. Deadline fast approaching. Hey, look, Republicans have been in this position time and time again, where the party in power wants to fund the government either with a clean CR or an omnibus, and Republicans just don't want to vote for it because of reasons. We don't like the president, we don't support what he's doing, and we just prefer to shut the government down. It has never worked. Democrats are in this position now where they don't really have. We got a clean CR. It's not ideal. A full year CR has a lot of problems. You got to work out all the anomalies, particularly with the Defense Department. But it funds the government, and so Democrats are going to be faced with a pretty stark choice here pretty soon. What do they do?
What are they going to do?
Yeah,
they're not going to vote for the CR. And look, when you control the House and the Senate and the White House, you have unified control of Washington. It's pretty hard to tell the guy who's out of power in the back corner of the room that they're the ones responsible for this. Now, under normal circumstances, if this were normal time, you'd see Democrats working to basically make up the votes for those right-winger Republicans who won't vote for it. That is not going to happen this time. Why? Because there were bills passed in the past year to fund the government here, and what we've seen Elon Musk and his band of 20-year-old bros, they are shutting down the government for money that has been rightfully authorized and appropriated. They closed the entire USAID. There was no authorization by Congress. They just did it. And so the Democrats who would normally work, appropriators who would normally work to try to make sure the function of government gets going, saying, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me.
Well,
so it's up to the, you know, this is going to be up to Johnson to pass.
Let's break that down. Okay. You're a House guy. So the procedural mechanism in the House, the first thing the Republicans have to do is pass the rule before you can vote on the underlying measure. That's a simple majority vote. I was told
there'd be no process on this podcast.
It's usually shirts and skins, and the party in power supports the rule, and then maybe they can go their own way on the underlying measure. If the Republicans get the rule and then they're voting on the CR, you don't think it gets any Democratic votes?
No, I don't.
Clean CR.
I think I don't. Well, because because all the Democrats have been asking for is, like, we want assurances that what we will, you know, send to the president and he will sign into law, that he then does what the law says.
Well, so
nobody believes he will do.
And I agree with you on this one, but I put it this way. If they're cutting a deal for spending, what's the deal? If the deal is we need you to agree to spending that we might not spend, then Democrats, I think rightfully, would say we're not going to sign off on a deal that isn't actually a deal. If you want us to sign off on spending, the spending happens. If you don't want us to sign off on spending, good luck passing it. You can't in the Senate without us, and you couldn't get it in the House once you cut the deal.
Yeah, but nobody even knows what that – what does that even look like? It's the law. So, you know, what other guarantees – do you want cement the spending mechanism?
That's the problem, is that there's no trust. And I think in the past, when you have bills signed and they go to the president, they get signed, there's a trust that will be fulfilled in best way that you can here. What Speaker Johnson is coming to the House Democrats, he may be asking for votes, And what did the president do within the past 24 hours here? He signed an executive order to close the Department of Education. Well, guess what? Education issues are something that Democrats happen to care about a little bit here. Maybe Republicans don't care about education, but Democrats do. We'd like to see our kids get smarter.
Is our children learning? Is our children learning?
Well, look.
So how do you say we're going to close the Department of Education? And by the way, we need your help on a CR to keep the government functioning. They're already shutting down the government. Why should we help them
do it? Will the Democrats agree to a spending bill that spends on a Department of Education that the administration isn't spending on? So I think the only way out of it, I'm expecting a shutdown, my base case. I think it will last for some number of weeks. And ultimately, the deal that would logically be the deal is Democrats will agree, I would bet, for like a month and say, we're going to see if over the next month, if the spending that we agree to is spent. If we agree to a spending deal for a month and the administration promises, pinky swears, they're going to do, and then they choose not to do, we're not going to agree to any more, and we'll just, you know, if you're going to shut down the pieces you don't like, we'll shut it all down. But that gets to, as you guys remember from a couple of weeks ago in the Substack, what if the president says, well, I'm going to fund the troops and the veterans' affairs with pay. I'm going to let them get paid anyway.
Throw me in that briar patch.
Right.
Throw me in that briar patch.
So I'm paying the soldiers. Do you want to sue me and say I can't pay the soldiers? Look, bring the case on.
He's already fired how many thousands of people from the VA department? So there's no one left to fire there. So even under your scenario, that doesn't quite work, Bruce. The ultimate problem here is that the president and Elon Musk are on a mission to, you know, radically scale back the function of government here because Donald Trump believes the government is out to get him, even though that he's in charge. And so how do the Democrats then try to work that this is like any sort of a normal situation here? Everything he's doing is because he believes there is some secret deep state in hidden rooms around the corner from this office here where people are doing stuff.
Why would he believe the government's out to get him? Like, I can't figure that one out.
It's not paranoia if they're actually out to get you. Well, look, we're gonna find out here very soon. I don't see it. Every chance we go into a technical shutdown Friday night, Saturday morning, and Democrats fold like a cheap suit by Sunday. We'll see.
I don't know. I feel like every time I recall a shutdown, the Republicans ended up getting blamed for it. We can go all the way back to Ted Cruz and the reading of Green Eggs and Ham. That didn't work out for anybody.
Speaking of education,
the Department of Government Efficiency, Bruce, we've talked a little bit about it. When DOGE started January, February, they were running over open ground. There were no cabinet secretaries in place. There were no deputy secretaries in place. None of the political appointees that run the agencies. There was no pushback. You just had career agency officials who weren't going to stick their head up, nor should they have. We're starting to see a little bit of a different relationship here between DOGE and the White House proper. Cabinet meeting yesterday, Trump made clear that the secretaries run their own agencies. He wants to keep good people. Does DOGE shift from more of a quote-unquote hatchet job or even a scalpel job into the advisory role in which it was originally constituted?
I'm not sure that was what it was originally constituted, but I think a combination of cabinet secretaries didn't show up to preside over somebody else getting rid of the agency that they are leading, combined with we're already seeing lawsuits of if Congress establishes the agency, then only Congress can get rid of the agency. And the 1974 Anti-Impoundment Act makes it clear that you can't just delete stuff. You can if you control a company in the private sector. You can't in the public sector. It does feel like we're going to probably see a bit of a phase shift. Something I find interesting on the DOGE, like overwhelmingly Americans think government's too big and it tries to do too many things. And everybody wants to see it shrink except for all of the programs that they like and that they care about. So one of the more interesting phenomenon that we saw, that we've been seeing, is that some of these Republican town halls and that we're hearing from Republicans about feedback back home, whether it's farmers or veterans or others who are like, hey, who's messing with the programs that actually benefit us right here in the district? So you may also run into a little bit of the politics of, you know, shut down government, just not my pieces of the government. And that could create a little bit of a drag, too.
Look, the way that I look at this here is this was not meant to be a thoughtful review of how to more effectively govern the United States. If it was, we wouldn't have had Elon Musk 2 weeks ago running around on stage in his goofy black outfit and hat with a chainsaw above his head. And so to hear the president say today, no, he's going to do a scalpel. That is nonsense. Musk, you look at every company he has, he blows it up and then he puts it back together. But we're not dealing with a company that's trying to drive electric cars or tweet. We're dealing with the United States of America. There is a way to reduce the size and scope of government effectively. And I will give a hat tip to my old boss, Al Gore, who did it right 30 years ago. How did he do it? In the Reinventing Government Initiative, he spent 6 to 9 months working with the agencies to come up with a giant report. What did that report do? Sent recommendations to Congress that then approved many of the things that went into effect to reduce the size and scope of government and also make it more efficient and responsive to Americans. That's the way you do it. That is not the way Elon Musk is going to do it. So, you know, we'll see what the consequences are, but it ain't going to be nice.
So, you know, look, all right, government shutdown, Doge, we've got tariffs on, we've got tariffs off, we've got, you know, the Ukrainian president being told off in the Oval Office, Canada, Mexico, Greenland, all of this sort of, look, I think even the administration acknowledges this is sort of chaos driven, move fast, break things is the ethos at play here. But Bruce, is there a larger bit of logic here to all of the craziness? I mean, to me, the one thing that stands out that you could maybe see as a common denominator is a sort of a consolidation effort to confront China. That's certainly what's at play in Europe, where it's like you guys need to get your shit together because we've got an 800-pound gorilla on the other side of the Pacific.
Yeah, so DT will accuse me, no doubt, hold your fire, but of sane splaining as opposed to, you know, suggesting maybe there is a grander strategy, a 3D chess to it all. I think China's one of it. If you say, what are the biggest three challenges, you might say China, you might say the bond markets, given American debt and where we've gotten to. And if you were a MAGA Republican, you'd say the establishment is too powerful and has controls too much. So what do you, what do you then do? Well, to deal with China, to your point, to back China off from increasingly controlling the Panama Canal, you claim we're going to take the Panama Canal back to make sure that their exports to the United States aren't just being routed through Mexico. You rattle the saber with Mexico. To make sure that we are meeting the challenge of an increasingly armed Arctic area, you threaten to take over Greenland. You beat up China. You get those changes. NATO needs to take care of, and Canada for that matter, need to do a better job in the theater where we don't have the bandwidth and the resources to fight. So what do? You make them pretty confident we're going to walk away. What happens? Germany finally says, okay, it's time for us to get in the game and defend our own backyard. You know, you see the same. You need the Middle East and India on allies. You bring them in. Add all of that up. That's the China strategy for the bond markets, because this year we're going to have to refinance $7 trillion of debt and the rates are way higher, which we're already spending more on interest than on defense. What you do is you have, the sense of tariffs on, tariffs off, chaos. That's driving right now the 10-year rate down. If people believe Doge is credibly going to reduce the fiscal thing, that helps you refinance, and the taxes and deregulation are going to come. That helps you refinance the $7 trillion you've got to get to this year, and then you can flip the switch to how do we grow the economy again when you've done that. To deal with the Washington establishment, you go after DEI, you go after Doge, you nominate some extraordinarily disruptive people whose background and raison d'etre is go after the establishment. Is that what they're doing? Maybe. Maybe that's just putting a logic that isn't strategy behind it, but
Revlon doesn't make enough lipstick to cover the pig that you just laid out for us here. If you're concerned about China, what you don't do is take the world order that has worked for the last 80 years and blow it up. I just don't think that's true. If you've got a problem with China, you don't pick a fight with Panama. That is just silly. It's not credible. Also, you want your allies to be close. You don't pick fight with your closest allies because you're mad at the guy on the other side of the ocean. What's the one thing? The one thing we know about Donald Trump when it comes to his sort of foreign policy thoughts is he likes dictators. He likes autocrats. He thinks Xi is the greatest guy out there. He thinks Putin's the greatest guy out there. The way he is treating Zelensky and the way that the Republicans on the Hill who cheered that guy when he bravely came before Congress to ask for help in this fight is shameful. It's embarrassing. And the only reason that Trump is doing this is because he didn't like the answer he got from Zelensky when he said, let's go after Hunter Biden. Dig up some dirt on Hunter Biden.
It might have helped if he didn't show up to the Oval Office dressed like a bouncer at a topless bar.
Yeah, and then and Musk is running around with his kid on his shoulders and his goofy hat and the whole it's such nonsense.
Dean, how do you know what bouncers at topless bars wear? See,
I've seen pictures on social media. I've never been. Look,
I mean, no, but I want to say something else. Hold on. I got to talk about what Bruce said on the budgets because he has the other side of the thing that he brought up here. It's like, if you're really concerned about our deficits, you don't pass a budget that raises the deficits by $2 trillion, which is what the Republicans did last week. You take on the challenge here. Should we be dealing with entitlements? Sure. Should we be dealing with the size of government growth? Absolutely. Should we be dealing with taxes? Not basically taking services and destroying government for those who need it the most to pay for tax cuts for Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and his trillionaire buddies. That's all he's doing.
Look, he's picking fights with friends. You know, these guys have nowhere else to go. And we are now in our 120th year of getting dragged into Europe's bullshit. We fought World War I, we fought World War II, we fought the Cold War, proxy wars in Korea and Vietnam. We've bombed Serbia and Kosovo, and here comes Ukraine. And it's like, enough's enough. And these guys, look, yes, we get benefits from providing the security umbrella, though it costs us an enormous amount. But these guys can barely get their defense spending to 2% of GDP. Their largest companies, Novo Nordisk, makes fat loss drugs and handbags. That's the level of innovation that Europe provides. And they, you know,
based on how much Ozempic we're using in this country, I think they know their market.
And you Trump's look saying enough's enough, and there's Trump saying enough is enough, and there's an enormous audience for that here in the United States.
It's right, but you know what?
And Zelensky is not the second coming of Winston Churchill. That was everybody's mistake.
I don't want to get into the Zelensky fight, but just on the narrow, like, for example, Panama. Panama's our friend, but if you look at the last 20 years, China's buying more and more of the ports and getting more and more insinuated in an area of critical importance geopolitically for the United States, and being nice, being friendly, nothing seemed to change that. You know me, I'm not mean, I don't like the saber rattling per se, but prior to the approach that the Trump administration has taken, we were increasingly losing the Panama Canal to China. All of a sudden, the Hong Kong operator just sold to BlackRock. You know, to me, could it have happened in a friendlier way? I kind of think the Biden administration tried, the Obama administration tried, Trump 1 tried. So Trump 2 is coming along with a baseball bat. And again, to stick to the narrowest of Panama, it, from what you read in the papers, looks like maybe that will be less of a geopolitical choke point risk for us if, God forbid, Dean's point about a hot war with China happens.
If you're worried about China's influence in the world, you know the one thing you shouldn't do? Blow up USAID. That was the most cost-effective program to help people around the world who are really struggling be on our side. But you blow it up, guess who's going to go into that vacuum? China.
Yeah.
You know, you want to effectively fight China, you do what we should have done years and years ago. You have a Pacific trade agreement that brings all the people on the Pacific Rim on our side. But that got blown up too. So, you know,
nice people don't make history. But this podcast does, and we'll be back to make more history when we'll bring you all of 2025. Guys, we got an extra minute. All of 2025 in 25 minutes. My apologies to all the young ears out there for the profanity on today's podcast. I blame you, David. You just got me so riled up. Bruce Melman, David Thomas, thank you for joining me on 14th and G.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you, my friend.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast, brought to you by the lobbying firm of Melman Consulting. For more, just type 14th and G podcast into your favorite search engine or look for 14th and G wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe.
Beam me up, Mr. Speaker.